Resources Committee to order. Please let the record reflect that Representative Birch, Representative Parrish, Representative Tallarico, Co-Chair Josephson, and myself, Representative Tarr, are present and that we have a quorum to conduct business. Today we're going to be hearing from industry partners on House Bill 111 and some reaction to that. And so before we do that, we want to take a moment to thank our LIO staff and our recording secretary for their work. And please, if you would, mute your cell phones. And with that, we will go ahead and invite Ms. Moriarty to testify. Oh, there you are.
Okay.
All right. So again, just as a review, it's Ms. Moriarty, then Mr. Bilbao. He'll be by telephone, Mr. Foley from Kalis, and then Mr. Hastings from SAE Exploration. And we'll do what we've been doing where we take questions, if that's okay with you, throughout the presentation, but we'll try to do them on each slide before we advance to the next slide.
Okay.
And please let the record reflect that Representative Drummond is also here. I know others are in transit to join us.
Lots of things going on. Yeah. Well, thank you and good evening. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Co-Chair Tarr, Co-Chair Josephson, thank you for the opportunity and invitation to testify. So as you know, AOGA is a private professional trade association that represents the majority of the oil and gas industry in Alaska. Collectively, governments in Alaska, state and local combined, received over $2.1 billion in taxes and revenue this last fiscal year. As our member companies evaluated House Bill 111, we viewed the bill with these principles in mind. One principle that is not on the previous slide, but it is incredibly important to us, is stability. And your consultant on Monday mentioned that Alaska is not the only government changing taxes, and he used the six-year-old slide to demonstrate that point. He was very direct and told you that industry, including the trade association, in fact, he called out AOGA directly, would deploy detracting themes such as stability, competition, and jobs as reasons why you should not increase government take. And one would think that by the way he talked about these quote-unquote themes, that industry is not being genuine and just providing the same old arguments that they deploy across the globe when governments consider changing tax policy. I just want to put it on the record that I personally take great exception to his choice of words, and frankly, I find them insulting. He was insinuating that industry is not credible and that these themes should not be believed. The reality is, the reason the industry does talk about stability, competition, and jobs across the globe is because they are real factors in making investment decisions, and they do have changes in government take do impact those three things. It is not a fabrication when I tell you that House Bill 111 will not provide stability and will not make Alaska more competitive and will likely not increase jobs in Alaska. It's not a made up thing. It is reality. IHS Energy is a global consulting firm led by Pulitzer Prize winner Dr. Daniel Yergin, and they developed the slide that your consultant referenced. And it has been updated since then, and I believe Representative Tallarico asked for the update. In fact, the updated slide was shared by IHS with Alaska's Oil and Gas Competitive Review Board this past May in Anchorage. I found it on the Department of Revenue's website last night, and I contacted IHS yesterday, and they emailed me late last night and said they have not since updated this slide since January of 2016. So the slide before you is the most current version. The updated slide does not show you more of the same from 2012 to 2016. What it does show you is that as prices crashed, governments were offering fiscal incentives. In fact, if Alaska had increased government take in January of 2016, which they did 6 months later with the passage of House Bill 247, Alaska would have been the only region on this chart to increase government take in a time of depressed oil prices. So why were regions offering fiscal incentives as prices crashed? Most of the world recognized that in the current market and commodity prices, high tax regimes or increasing taxes would discourage investment. That's why if you look at 2016 as the price crashed, there are several green boxes for 2016, regions offering fiscal incentives, not increasing government take. So having your consultant share older data from other consultants may demonstrate that he either didn't take enough time to prepare for his presentation, or he is possibly utilizing the data to drive an agenda.
Ms. Moriarty?
Yes.
We're not going to make statements like that in this committee. So you're not going to impugn the motives of that individual. If you want to respond to anything that was said, that's fine, but we're not going to do that.
So thank you, Chairman Tarr. I am responding to the slide with updated information, and I just think that it was irresponsible to suggest that the slide had not been updated. So that's all I'm trying to say, because here's the updated information, and it shows you what it shows you.
Sure. That's fair, but in fairness, he didn't say that the slide hadn't been updated. So
I just wanted to
point
it out.
We did put in a request at the request of Representative Tallarico for him to respond to.
Madam Chair, I just want to say it is
Representative
appreciated
Birch?
To have the updated information. Thank you.
Representative Birch, we're also not going to interrupt the chair. So if you would like to be called on, then I'd be happy to do that, but we're not going to interrupt the chair. Representative Birch.
I just wanted to say it's very nice to have updated and current information rather than having misinformation presented to this this committee. And I do appreciate the fact that this has come forward. And if it's updated again and more recently, I'd like to see that. And we also, we've talked about the competitive review board, competitiveness review board. And Madam Chair, I would request that we have some engagement with the competitiveness review board with this committee to have, you know, perhaps assist us in our effort, because I think they have a duty and a responsibility here as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Birch. Any member is welcome to engage with them outside of the committee, and if time allows, we'll consider that request. Please
thank
continue.
You.
Yep. So to speak directly to the piece of legislation in front of you, we have evaluated the bill by section and provided a summary chart of which sections constitute a tax increase or an increased cost to industry and which sections are true credit reform, as several policymakers have said they are interested in fixing credits on the North Slope as a step toward a comprehensive fiscal plan. This desire to fix North Slope credits is irregardless of the increased activity and production we have recently seen on the slope. And while we have not seen the updated chart from the Department of Revenue that breaks out Cook Inlet and North Slope credits, we do know that last year there was over $6.6 billion in total investment on the slope. And the industry earned a fraction of that in credits on the slope at $393 million, or 6% of the total investment. And we can estimate, based on the total North Slope production versus the total revenue, we can estimate North Slope revenue to state and local government at right around $2 billion last year. So $6.6 billion in investment, $393 million in credits, and around $2 billion in revenue to state and local governments. So in our view, the credits have been and can continue to be a good return on the state's investment. And the presentation today will reiterate that throughout the presentation. So just looking at it by section. Increasing interest to 6 years of compounded interest will simply increase our costs of doing business and has nothing to do with tax credits. Section 2 was in the governor's original oil tax bill last session. Even though House Bill 247 was touted as a tax credit reform bill, it had many provisions, such as this one, that had nothing to do with tax credits. Raising the minimum tax is not just a 1% increase. It is a significant increase, ranging anywhere from 25% to an infinite increase, depending on which company you are. Your consultant asked industry to be specific in how they would change their business plans. Last year, the industry did testify that this increase alone would likely lead to the reduction of one drilling rig for at least 6 months. So this section alone. So make no mistake, House Bill 111 will impact investment decisions, and companies are not likely to just keep spending the way they have as if nothing changed in tax policy. You may hear more specific examples later this evening and from the individual companies on Friday. Not allowing credits to be applied to the minimum tax floor or hardening the floor is another tax increase. And while this one is directly related to credits, this proposal changes a key provision of the purpose of credits. For some companies, using credits against the minimum tax is the only way they can continue to invest, especially in lower price environments. Several of you have mentioned throughout these proceedings that you are concerned with the complexity of the tax system. Well, if you are looking to make our tax system less complex, the second part of Section 3 should be removed. This proposal would move the tax to more of a monthly tax, where companies are expected to accurately submit estimates each month versus doing a true-up at the end of the year. Again, if you are a business owner, how would you like to file your taxes every month accurately versus having an annual true-up so you can utilize the very incentives that may have attracted you to invest in the first place? So this is a tax increase, and it does change a key provision of the tax system. The NOL has generally matched the tax rate throughout Alaska's net tax system, and this provision immediately penalizes companies for investing in Alaska while they are losing money. Reducing the NOL was not part of Governor Walker's original tax bill last session. In fact, Department of Revenue officials have testified in the past to the importance of the NOL for all companies, regardless of size. In fact, in the first presentation by the department on House Bill 247 last February, the department clearly stated right on their slide that House Bill 247 was designed to protect the NOL credits. So the original 247 did not include any changes to the NOL. So it was interesting to us that the department now says it may be reasonable to reduce the NOL. Adding insult to injury to Section 5 is Section 6. There have been very specific examples in the past as to why the NOL is a playing field leveler for newer or smaller companies in Alaska. And I suspect you may hear more of that later tonight. Reducing the NOL and eliminating the ability for these companies to be eligible for cash payments is a double whammy. It is important to note that if this provision is passed, there will be no more cashable credits on the North Slope, because today the only North Slope cashable credit that remains after all the changes that have taken place is the NOL credit. So before I discuss why changing the per barrel credit is a tax increase, I'd like to remind the committee as to how these so-called credits came about. When Senate Bill 21 was originally drafted and introduced, the tax rate was 25%. After it was introduced and modeled during the modeling, the department and the legislature discovered that Senate Bill 21, as originally introduced, was a very regressive tax, and the effective tax rate would be dramatically lowered in low oil prices. So the department and the legislature worked together to create nothing more than a math formula, which kept the tax rate at about an effective 25% rate over a range of prices and created an element of progressivity back into the tax system versus having a true regressive system. So how did they do that? How did the legislature and the administration create this math formula? Well, it's the per barrel credit. Changing this credit, or so-called credit, changes the structure of the tax, and it is an immediate tax increase on the core fields that provide a little over 90% of the current production. So experts across the spectrum, from the legislative consultants to current DOR officials, have recognized that the per-barrel credit is not really a credit. As Analytica described, the per-barrel credit is really a misnomer. And even though Director Alper was not at DOR during the creation of Senate Bill 21, he did reiterate the exact same reason it was created just a year and a half ago at a joint House and Senate Resources Committee in Kenai. He said, some of them, credits, are integral parts of the tax regime. The 20% capital credit in ACES and the per barrel credit in Senate Bill 21, those are very much offsets to what otherwise would be a very high tax rate. He went on to say that with Senate Bill 21, the credit is an offset to the tax and is designed to create a progressive element, a little bit lower tax rate at lower prices, a higher tax rate at higher prices. So it's hard to really consider them a credit in the context of an inducement to doing work. It's really what we're calling an integral part of the system. So this change that is being proposed would be a fundamental change to an integral part of the tax system, and we would argue has nothing to do with the credits many claim need to be reformed. Even though Section 9 may seem moot if the NOL is reduced or is no longer eligible for cash payments for the North Slope, we did want to bring up that there is some uncertainty that this section creates. It is unclear to us, the way the bill is currently drafted, how this section would be applied and to which companies. So if this section remains, we would ask for some further clarity on when credits are earned, how this would apply, because I've had all of my member companies look at it, and we cannot, we're just unclear as to how this would be applied. Lastly, I wanted to briefly reiterate our testimony that we gave last year, that by changing the structure of the tax by preventing the gross value at the point of production from going below zero creates uncertainty and has nothing to do with tax credits. So in summary, 9 of the 11 policy sections of the bill would increase cost and or taxes on the industry at a time when oil prices are still in this lower for longer range. In fact, some companies are even still losing money in Alaska today. A little less than half of the bill addresses the so-called need for further changes to the tax system. So the oil and gas industry is constantly evolving. That is true. Global markets and prices that are almost impossible to predict. I don't know anyone who ever gets them exactly right. Emerging technologies and techniques to tap additional resources. Enhanced monitoring systems to protect the environment. Geopolitical changes. But the one area that can remain stable, if the government chooses to, is the fiscal system. If an oil company were to call us today and say, hey, should I come to Alaska, who would want to say come up where the policy is constantly changing? There have also been claims that industry asked for over half of these changes. And I just wanted to summarize our position as AOGA, the Trade Association for the Industry, on the 6 changes and the one before you. You can see we did support the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. We did not request that piece of legislation. That was something that was born out of the legislature. And we did end up supporting Senate Bill 21, but we always testified on several various concerns, such as the 35% tax rate. So you will see that we supported 2 out of the 6 and 7 if you include the one before you. Alaska has so much potential. We do have great rocks and great geology, but House Bill 111 will not bring more production or investment to Alaska, and it will make Alaska less competitive, and it may bring in some short-term revenue, but House Bill 111 has the real potential to lose out on long-term revenue over time through lost royalties, production, corporate income tax, and property tax if projects are not brought online or if projects infield don't happen. So I will leave you with this slide, and that is the reminder that fair share is truly in the eyes of the beholder. gaining increases in government take through the mechanisms of House Bill 111 will not come close to solving Alaska's fiscal situation. And I can sympathize with you in this enormous task that you as the legislature have. I, as an Alaskan, want you to. And as a mom raising three little Alaskans, I want a sustainable future. But the industry, I get this question a lot. Well, shouldn't the industry be part of the solution? And I would argue that we are part of the solution today. We are the largest contributor to state government by a long way. We may not be covering 90% of the budget anymore, but we are still the largest revenue generator for the state of Alaska. And we can continue to be a strong partner if additional projects and production are brought online. So this is not just a theme I'm deploying. I'm telling you straight up that House Bill 111 will hurt Alaska's overall economy, and we urge the committee to reconsider this bill. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I am happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions for Ms. Moriarty? Representative Birch.
I'd just like to say a great presentation in about 20 minutes. I think we've got it posted on a basis.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, good.
We
thank you.
Patrick.
Good, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Rauscher? And let the record reflect that Representative Rauscher joined at 6:45.
Thank you. Through the chair, I was just, do we have a phone number to contact you if we want some help with these slides or an email address?
Yes, I can provide it to the committee.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Anybody else? Okay, thank you for your presentation.
Thanks.
Next, we're going to hear from Mr. Bilbao, and he will be on the phone. You should have just a one-pager, basically, that is their presentation.
Good evening, Madam Co-Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you. And we're just pulling up your one-pager, and so we'll just take a moment to do that so that folks following along can see what we're talking about. Here we go.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Birch.
I would request that we give Mr. Bilbao an opportunity. I was a little disconcerted about interruptions that happened in the last presentation. I listened to 2 hours of Mr. Brenna without interrupting, and I think there was, we can dispute the presentation accuracy or something, but I think I would suggest that we do it at a later point so as not to disrupt the flow of the presentation. And I think it is relevant if there's new information available, and that slide was very important to me because it the one that was referenced that we had presented to earlier about the government reaction to market changes. And I think the fact that's relevant information, I think we need to make sure that we do have the best information available.
Sure.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah. I think that the chairs will make decisions about the management of the committee, but again, appreciate your comments.
Thanks.
Please go ahead. Mr. Bilbao?
Yes, ma'am. Was that directed to me?
Yes. Please go ahead. And I don't know how you're planning to cover your slide, but we'll try to let you get through, and then we'll take questions when you're done.
Thank you very much. Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Josephson, and members of the House Resources Committee, for the record, my name is Damian Bilbao. I'm the Vice President of Commercial Ventures for BP in Alaska. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today, and I apologize for not being there in person, and appreciate the co-chair's willingness to allow testimony by phone tonight. I'd like to share BP's views on HB 111 against the four principles presented by BP before this committee last month, and share why BP sees HB 111 as currently written as a risk to the Alaska economy and a disincentive to investment in Alaska. First, however, I would like to start by expressing BP support for the testimony provided by Kara Moriarty on behalf of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Whenever Kara testifies or presents, the audience is receiving the product of a large number of hours of work by experts, including multiple international tax experts and a former commissioner of revenue for the state of Alaska. And all of those people must align on conclusions and messages. I have heard some suggest that this is an easy task, given the nature of the industries represented. They are mistaken. Kara's presentation is powerful because of the depth of the analysis and the cumulative debate that produces it. The fact that Kara does a great job delivering it is just a nice bonus. I appreciate the many hours of testimony the committee has endured, and it is also important to remember that producing oil in Alaska is tough and expensive work, requiring a significant investment just to maintain production decline. North Slope fields would naturally decline at well over 10% every year without a material level of investment. And it is only through significant drilling, facilities work, and innovation by hardworking men and women that decline is mitigated, and that you can see the type of increase in production that we saw through TAPS in 2016. Alaska today makes up less than 5% of U.S., not global, U.S. oil production, versus more than 25% during the 1980s. We will continue to compete for investment because there are many other places, even within the U.S., where investment can go if it delivers a better business outcome. I decided to focus today on the most fundamental and aligning factor that we should all care about, the Alaska economy. Our fiscal gap should not be addressed at the expense of the health of our state economy. And whether we all care to admit it or not, the health of our Alaskan economy can be directly linked and measured by the amount of oil that is flowing down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, or TAPS. And that system, by the way, showed an increase in production in 2016 versus 2015, and has also seen more flow so far in 2017 than the same time period in 2016. During my previous testimony, I shared four principles that BP will use to assess oil fiscal policy. We have tested HB 111 against those four principles, and I am prepared to share with you our views and why BP believes HB 111 as proposed would be a damaging policy for Alaska. The first policy principle is encouraging more flow of oil down taps. HB 111 makes investment in Alaska less competitive because it makes production more expensive. We can argue about fair shares and slices of the pie, but the irrefutable fact is that higher taxes means higher costs, which means lower profit and cash flow in Alaska compared to other options across the U.S. and the world. As a result, investment dollars will flow elsewhere, as it was doing before SB 21 passed. The second principle is the extension of the life of Prudhoe and Kuparuk, because these enable other fields to be brought on stream. The change to the sliding scale tax credit for legacy production would represent an immediate and significant tax increase on the core fields that underpin the future development on the North Slope. HB 111 would raise the cost of producing each barrel at Prudhoe and Kuparuk, meaning that the economic life at each field would be shortened. The third principle is encouraging an increase or more independence on the North Slope, which we believe is in the best interests of the state and the industry. HB 111 would push independence off the North Slope as a result of weaker economics and continued fiscal uncertainty, making it more difficult to obtain financing. And I believe you'll hear directly from some of these companies this week. The last principle is not picking winners and losers. And there are clear losers under HB 111. Any company that invested in Alaska expecting a certain return for their investment would be a loser under HB 111. And so would the Alaska economy and workers that will see even more slowdown in the oil sector. Now, BP understands that the legislature has a difficult task before in addressing the fiscal gap without damaging the economy. That is an unenviable task, and we understand that a discussion around oil taxes was to be expected. However, it is critical that in this oil price environment, changes in Alaska's oil taxes and policies are conducted with a scalpel and not a hatchet, so that corrections are narrowly tailored to correct deficiencies without causing long-term harm to our state's economic engine. We urge caution so that we can celebrate Prudhoe Bay and Taft's 40th birthday this year with optimism rather than concern. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee members have.
Thank you, Mr. Bilbao. And I want to welcome Representative Johnson, who joined us about 10 minutes ago, if she could be added for the record. Are there any questions for Mr. Bilbao? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bilbao, if you'd be so good as to say from where you're sitting, what do you see as the what flaws do you see for us to correct in the existing tax system, which would positively impact the state's bottom line in the short term?
Representative Parrish, the chair, we believe that the current policy is providing exactly what it was intended to do and what's in the best interest of the state, and that's delivering more production, more discoveries in the North Slope, more independence exploring, overall best for those short and long term of the state. I appreciate you have a short term challenge that needs to be addressed, but it's important to do so without making the state economy even worse off, both short and long term.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? I think that's it for you then. There's no additional questions, Mr. Bilbao. We appreciate you being on the phone this evening. No problem at all to be on the phone. And we'll look forward to hearing from you as we continue our work on this legislation.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Have a good evening.
You as well. Thank you. Next, we will invite Mr. Pat Foley, the Senior Vice President of Operations for Kalis Energy. And this will be the first time Kalis is presenting to the committee because you weren't in the first go-around of presenters. So we're happy to have you here this evening and glad you could join us.
Thank you and good evening. Appreciate the opportunity to visit before you. For the record, my name is Pat Foley. I'm a Senior Vice President with Kalis Energy Alaska. I did actually present the first round before this committee, I think, 2 weeks ago. Kalis is a member of AOGA. Kara Moriarty did a good job of talking about the details. I'm not going to repeat any of that. The slide pack I have before you includes many of the slides that I did present to you before, and I'm not going to go through the details on them. They're just there for your reference, and I'm probably going to pull a couple key points out. What I am going to do is talk about the high-level impacts of House Bill 111. I'm going to remind you why Kalis, even though we're a small company, it's a company that I believe matters to the economy in Alaska. And I'm going to give you some actual details about the element-by-element impacts of HB 111 to Kalis. So they're personal to us. They wouldn't apply to any other companies or any other projects. So this is a slide you've seen before. It's just our portfolio. And the takeaway should be that, you know, to remind you that Kalis is an explorer. We're a developer, we're a producer, we are truly a partner with the state of Alaska helping develop the state's resources. Kalis acquired the Pioneer assets, and that whole heritage is about 15 years. So we're not a brand new company. We've been trying to make a go of a business on our slope for 15 years. The next slide, this is our NUNA development. And this is really just a reminder that the policies you make will impact projects, it'll impact our economics, and most importantly, it'll impact the timing of those projects. So, you know, NUNA, just as an example, is a project that at peak is 25,000 barrels a day, it's hundreds of jobs, and it represents about $2.2 billion of total revenue to the state of Alaska. That $2.2 billion comes from $1 billion in royalty, $500 million in net profit share leases. That's a term you might not be familiar with. Our Agouric leases have both a royalty component and a net profit share component. So when companies talk about government take and company take, just remember that Agouric has one of the lowest company takes, one of the highest government takes of any project by virtue of the fact of that net profit share lease. We're not the only project that has those burdens, but we do have them. And then there's about $700 million of production tax. Under HB 111, when we analyze all of the components for a specific project like NUNA, and when we model it at $70, and when we take a net present value, because of the changes of HB 111, if they were to become law, that has the effect of increasing the oil price required for the project to make sense. It increases the price that is required to attract the capital that's needed to invest. And to give you some firm numbers, for NUNA, that increase is somewhere in the range between $5 and $7 a barrel. So for a project to go forward today versus if this becomes law, the oil price would have to be about $5 to $7 higher to let that project go forward for an economic venture. Smith Bay is the other project. This is a lot of work yet to be done. It's a very substantial field. It represents quite a lot of oil, quite a lot of jobs. And just as a reminder, when this project comes online, it'll start well over 100,000 barrels a day, some number like that. Kalis will be well over any threshold that would be eligible for cash credits. So you should not have a concern that a project like Smith Bay would be a huge cash credit draw, because we would not be eligible for them. You know, kind of just to summarize everything, Kalis represents the potential for about 2 billion barrels of additional oil through TAPS, more than 2,000 direct jobs, and contributions to the state economy of about $34 billion. So this next slide, I have shown this before. You're becoming way more familiar with it. I would refer to this slide as sort of an example of how Alaska is going out of business one produced barrel at a time. We're an industry that produces, and we deplete that resource, and every barrel we sell is one less barrel to sell. So every barrel we sell basically is decreasing the value of our business. And it's a negative profile, and the hope, the opportunity, is for additional projects, whether they're ours, whether they're elsewhere. That's what's going to save Alaska's economy. That's what's going to save the oil industry. And tax policy will have a direct impact on whether those projects happen, but most importantly, the pace at which they'll happen. So the next slide, these are just details of some of the key elements. So there's certain parts of this bill that are harmful to all North Slope investors, and there's other elements that are harmful kind of exclusively to the new companies that are trying to grow and incubate a business on the North Slope. This just shows which those are. I'm not going to go through the details. You can read. But what I would ask, and it's the same question or the same ask that I think everybody has made, and that is, as you consider changes to tax policy, the first question is, what's the fiscal goal? What's the policy of the state? And secondly, consider each of these elements and whether or not they'll be helpful to attract investment, helpful to grow the economy, or if they'll be harmful. when I look at HB 111 as in its current form, I think it does a fine job of addressing the immediate cash concerns of the state of Alaska, but I think over the long term, it is very harmful to the economy, and it's harmful because it's going to slow projects and it's going to let some oil stay in the ground and not be produced. And so this is my last slide, and I'm going to take a little bit of time to set the stage here. This is a slide that we have taken HB 111, we've evaluated our NUNA project, and we have a very elaborate economic model, and we can basically turn items on, turn items off, change the, so we, in an iterative manner, we went through sort of these key components of raising the minimum floor, not allowing NOLs to be eligible for cash credits, the per barrel credit change, and then a hard minimum floor, and then finally the change in the net operating loss going from 35% to 15%. So this, by design, this chart is dimensionless because each one of these elements actually interacts with one another. You could not take the sum of all of these negative bars, and that would not be the sum of all the negative elements. But the whole intention here is to give you some visual, honest, graphic representation of each one of these components. And what you'll see is for Kalis, and it's specific to Kalis, for NUNA, specific to NUNA. You know, the change in the minimum tax is a very, very small impact compared to the enormity of the impact that results from the net operating loss change. And with that, I'm going to keep my comments brief, and I'm happy to try and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. And can I please apologize, because you were here, I got ahead of myself. Our next presenter was not with us at the last round of presentation. So my sincere apologies for that, and appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
We have Representative Parrish with the first question, then Representative Rauscher, and then Representative Birch. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of questions about specific values. What is the expected outlay for the NUNA project?
So NUNA, we have spent to date about $200 million. That was spent drilling two wells that are in the ground and installing our facilities, our gravel. There's a gravel pad, there's a gravel road, and some of the initial engineering design. There is yet to be spent about another $1 billion. And probably simple ballpark numbers, that's about $300 million in facilities and about $700 million in wells.
Thank you. And
follow up.
Thank you. And for Smith Bay?
Smith Bay is a project that we have drilled two exploration wells. We'll be back out there with one more appraisal well. The development is purely conceptual at this time. I'm confident total development costs will be in excess of $10 billion.
One more
follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. So I noticed on your last slide, the no NOL cash payments, net operating loss cash payments, is a pretty significant block. Out of the more than $10 billion, what is it? About $11 billion. How much of that would you anticipate taking as cash subsidies, and how much as against future tax liability?
So, Representative Parrish, through the chair, by the time Kalis is able to proceed on Smith Bay, we would be in excess of probably 35,000 barrels a day. So under the current bill, with a 15,000 barrel a day limit, we would not be eligible for any cash credits. So all of our lease expenditure would roll forward as a net operating loss.
Okay, we'll have a round two, I'm sure, if we have time. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Through the chair, earlier the representative from Juneau had asked the representative from BP his take I guess it ended up where he said that SB 21 was a pretty good deal comparatively. What's your take? I think his actual question was, what's a good tax policy? Is that the way you look at it also?
So, Representative Rauscher, through the chair. So, recall, Kalis actually purchased the Pioneer assets. We committed to Smith Bay. We made the commitment. We committed to Nuna. We sanctioned the project, and we committed to the two exploration wells at Smith Bay under the regime that was established under Senate Bill 21. Okay? So that policy attracted newcomers, it leveled the playing fields, and it basically encouraged investment on the North Slope. Under HB 247, a company like Kalis, we took a little bit of a haircut. It didn't kill us, but our projects became less valuable. With the changes that are proposed under HB 111, what it would mean is oil price would have to be about $5 to $7 higher for a project like Nuna to go forward.
So,
follow-up, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Follow-up. So, should 111 go in place like it is, what do you see?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, I think the investments in the state of Alaska will be slowed. I think the economy will be harmed. I can't say that it destroys the projects, but it makes the economics less robust, and it probably slows them down because we'll have to wait for higher prices.
And just as a follow-up, I wasn't insinuating that it would go into effect the way it is. It could have a lot of changes, so I didn't mean to lead anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Foley, for your presentation. You know, SB 21, by any measure, has been a success from the standpoint of an uptick in production. We're seeing new investment in the North Slope. We're seeing, a lot of excitement and energy, and you're certainly a part of that. The fiscal note that we got that was attached to 111, every bill has to have a fiscal note, indicated that by 2025, in just 8 short years, a massive tax increase of over $300 million would be leveled against investment and be realized by the state should that happen. So so HB 111 represents a significant tax increase for the state of Alaska. One question I had come up earlier, and that relates to royalty shares. And the most significant component of state revenue, if you will, is a royalty share, as anyone might expect. And typically, that's a 1/8 share or 12.5%. But more recently, I think some of the newer fields have had a 1/6 royalty, which I can't remember the exact number. I think it's 16-point-something%. But it's a significantly higher share. And I was wondering if you could speak to how that's been applied, because I'm not entirely sure I know, and then to which fields, and then how that has impacted investment decisions by the state of Alaska, basically incrementally increasing that royalty share.
Yep. So, Representative Birch, through the chair, to answer your first question about Kalis specifically, so at Agouric, we have some 1/8 leases, which in addition to that are also burdened by a 30% net profit share. We also have some 1/6 leases. So Kalis does not enjoy the 1/8 leases that exist. A real quick history on the state of Alaska. Originally, all the oil and gas leases had a 1/8 royalty, and then there became a net profit share component. And at some time, it was a fixed 1/8 plus a 30%, 1/8 plus a 40%. There were some lease sales that actually had a bid variable of a net profit share amount. And then I think the state realized that it's just really an accounting difficulty to keep track of that. And I think they no longer are issuing leases with net profit share. So very simply, all of the leases in and around infrastructure have a 1/6 royalty that are issued today, and some of the very remote areas still carry a 1/8 royalty.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question for you, Mr. Foley, you said that, I just want to be clear, under the bill you would not be eligible after the 1st of January for cashable credits, which are not a guarantee, as we've seen in any case. But if the bill as written were not to succeed, you would remain eligible because you're under 50,000 barrels, correct?
Yes. To answer your question, we would remain eligible. However, So think about Smith Bay. There's probably 2 or 3 years of intensive capital infrastructure building before first oil. So all of those would be eligible for credits. Mm-hmm. But probably when the oil field starts up, it would be well over 50,000 barrels a day. We would not be eligible for cash credits. To give you some idea of magnitude, if the total capital was about $10 billion, mm-hmm. you might spend $3 or $4 billion in advance of cash flow, and then you'll spend another $7 or more billion drilling wells. So that first tranche might be eligible for cash credits under the current fiscal system.
Follow up, Representative Josephson.
So under the existing fiscal system, it would be, as a cashable credit, would be 0.35 of perhaps $3.5 to $4 billion. And then after that, you'd be in production in excess of 50,000 barrels, and we would wait to deduct 35%. We would have, there'd be a formula where you would secure your NOLs according to the formula after your other CapEx and operating expense deductions.
Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. If I understand the point, if I draw your attention to my slide number 4, mm-hmm. What this tries to show is the total cash that would be paid to the state of Alaska for a project like Smith Bay, mm-hmm. and in simple numbers, it's about $15 billion in royalty, mm-hmm. and about $10 billion in production taxes. And you're right. If we carry that loss forward, the payment of those production taxes are delayed, but royalty starts on day one.
Mm-hmm.
Follow up?
I guess my concern is this, Mr. Foley. The people I've met, the people I've met in the industry across the board are good people. I mean, that's been my experience. And the people in your group, I know it's generally categorized as the independents versus the legacy fields, and I'm sure it's more nuanced than that, but are certainly part of that great group of people. But the idea that my state brought in $1.2 billion in FY17, and I would go to a constituent and say, I got this, trust me, we're going to make tens of billions of dollars over the life of something, but we're vulnerable to having to apportion $3.5 billion of the expense. Without knowing, I mean, it just, there's so many variables in this that I don't know that I can guarantee a result. And, I mean, we've had this discussion before, but how do I get comfortable with that? How do I get comfortable going to a place where I'm recommending to a constituent we spend three times, granted, over a span of time, over a decade of development or whatever it takes, what we brought in a single year with the hope of bringing in much more? I just don't know. If you can explain that to me, it would be helpful.
So, Co-Chair Josephson, I'm not sure I can explain it. I would offer this. I mean, I consider the state as a co-investor with us, and I consider that cash credit as not as a subsidy but as a co-investment. And what the state gets for that co-investment is so let's use the numbers I talked about for Smith Bay. Let's say there were, I'll make it easy, let's say there were $3 billion. $3.5 billion worth of investment before cash flow, before we were above 50,000 barrels a day with a 35% tax rate. So that's about $1 billion that the state would contribute to that project. And in return, they would get about $28 billion in royalty, production tax, and ad valorem. So a return of about 28-1.
And
follow up?
What is the reliability of that? I mean, whether it's our own permitting system that is the interference, whether it's the failure to prove up the reserve, how do I treat that as something I can count on?
So I don't know that you can count on it. I don't know that you can bank upon it. I will say this. There's a tremendous distinction between an exploration activity and a development activity. But when Smith Bay becomes a reality, when a commitment is made to expend up to $10 billion, it'll be with a very, very, very high assurance that everybody's going to prosper and get their money back.
Thank you.
I have a question, Mr. Foley. Since Representative Birch brought up the royalty issue, I think it might be a good time to talk about the royalty relief that your company has enjoyed. And if you could just give members who aren't familiar with royalty relief and what that means in terms of, you know, the current situation, as I understand it, you have a 60% reduction in the state's royalty. And, you know, there are some benchmarks that need to be met. And my understanding is that it's the wish of your company to extend that royalty relief beyond the end of March 31st, which I think is a particular point in time where we revisit this issue. But I may not have that date. But if you could please talk about the royalty relief and that process.
Sure, I'd happy to. So, Madam Chairman, there's two different issues. So at Agouric, there is a royalty modification that was agreed to back at field startup when that project was originally sanctioned. And again, all of the leases in the field, there's some nuance, but they either are 1/8 royalty, 30% net profit, or a 1/6 royalty. When that royalty modification was granted, all of the net profit stayed the same. The royalties were reduced to 5%. Until the net profit share, one of the key leases, became positive, when it actually started making a net profit share payment. I can't forecast exactly when that's going to happen, but internally we are planning for a world for that royalty modification to begin to end, because the lease 036 is paying a net profit share within the next year or two or three. It's dependent upon price. It's dependent upon our future, you know, investments in that field. But so the royalty modification for Agouric will start to go away in the next year or two or three. Second to that, we had a separate application for royalty modification for Nuna. And this was during a time of very similar oil price today. It was when Senate Bill 21 was law. And that royalty modification was granted. One of the conditions of that royalty modification is that first oil would have to begin by, I think it's late in 2018, maybe even 17. The odds of that happening are low, and one possibility is that we apply for an extension, and that'll be granted or it won't be granted.
And as a follow-up, Mr. Foley, I think we could anticipate that you would, you know, apply to continue that royalty relief at this time.
That would be a safe assumption, yes.
And just one final question for me on that. I mean, would you say it's been your experience then that the state has been willing to, you know, use this process and as a recognition of the economics of any of these opportunities changing, given, you know, the low price environment, which is what prompted you to seek the royalty relief in the first place?
Yes, I think it did. It worked as it was intended to. There were marginal projects that sort of got over the threshold a little bit because of the help that was created under the royalty modification. I think there are three North Slope fields that have enjoyed royalty modification. So there are Agouric, it's Nikaichek, and then Nuna. And then the Cook Inlet, there was a bill that granted royalty relief for six or seven specific Cook Inlet fields.
Thank you. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foley, the representative from downtown Anchorage had indicated some concerns about the billion-dollar investment. Could you remind me on House Bill 247 on NOLs that operate, is that limited to $35 million a year, or is that in other words, is that so? In other words, that bill, the state's not going to be into it for $1 billion. Basically, they have to kind of chip away at that over some period of time. Is that correct?
Yeah, Representative Birch, through the chair. So under 247, some of the changes were made. It took the net operating loss, all credits, and it basically cut it in half. And so the sort of the sweet spot is you could recoup up to I think, $61 million in any one year for any one company.
So to the concern, I mean, so it basically, again, through the chair, so that basically, to the concern that you'd have a significant investment in there without any income to offset it, it'd have to be metered out over some period of time.
Great. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Josephson has a comment, and then Representative Parrish.
Representative Birch, I think the concern is that even if the amount of the annual outlay per company is capped, under the existing system, we have no control over what's happening, what credits are accruing above that cap. And so it becomes this extra thing on the state's ledger, just like the pension system and the school debt reimbursement. It's this column that's there seemingly forever, and that's a concern, I think. But we can dialogue off record about it.
Okay, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly hope you succeed. I share some reservations about the state's degree of exposure. I wonder if instead of having the for Smith Bay, if instead of having the $3.5 billion as a subsidy, instead they were offered as a low-cost loan, or heck, a no-cost loan, if need be, how would that affect the economics of your project?
Yeah, Representative Parrish, through the chair, there are a number of things the state could do to help put us in the same financial position that we thought we were in when we made those investments. Things like low interest rate loans helps. Our ability to carry forward those loss credits until we can utilize them helps. Any investment in infrastructure helps.
Thank you.
Representative Rauscher.
I have to apologize, but I have to leave.
Okay.
I just thought I'd
apology
say
accepted.
I'm not walking out on anybody.
We'll miss you, but we'll see you soon.
And
thank you. Okay, Representative Johnson has to leave. I'm glad we only have one presenter left, and for those members, we'll make sure to share any information that comes out between now and the end to make sure they haven't missed out on any important discussion. Are there any other questions before we do our last presentation?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here. I won't forget you. I promise the next time. Our final presenter of the evening is, in fact, the individual who was not with us in the previous hearings that we had. And the reason I wanted to mention that was just that Mr. Hastings had made a request, but we hadn't made the opportunity available to all support industry businesses. And so in the interest of fairness, we wanted to wait till this go around. And so we did invite Mr. Hastings as well as Lyndon if they were interested. And I believe they were not available, but Mr. Hastings is. And so we wanted to hear from you. So I'm glad you could be here this evening. Welcome.
Well, good evening. For the record, my name is Jeff Hastings. I'm the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer for SA Exploration, and I'm the Managing Partner for Kupik SAE. I'd like to start by thanking the co-chairs Tarr and Joseph and the members of the committee for the opportunity to give testimonial tonight and kind of give a Alaska contractor's perspective on the current oil and gas programs, as well as some of our thoughts around HB 111. A bit about SA Exploration. We are a explorer. We are currently the holder of Alaska tax credits, and our main business is a prime contractor to the oil and gas community in Alaska. Our team has been partnered with the Kupik Corporation for more than 20 years now. We employ an average of 400 people in the state a year. Our Kupik SAE joint venture is a consistent source of revenue for the Kupik Corporation and its shareholders, the village of Nawiksit, and hundreds of Alaska families that are benefiting from each job that we shoot. We're committed to preferentially hiring Alaska Natives and Alaskan residents, and we're proud of having more than an 80% Alaskan hire rate currently. We're also committed to using Alaskan subcontractors and suppliers, and slide two is just a, although it's the font is a little small, you can see the 190 Alaskan suppliers that, we currently use on an annual basis. What I thought I'd do is give you a little snapshot for those of you that aren't familiar with seismic, and we're typically the first operation in our exploration program, either before leasing or after leasing. A lot of is a lot of times we're the pointy end of the spear, so to speak. The seismic data is a critical information that's essential to the success of any exploration program. With the passage of SB 21 and the investment that it drew, we were able to use new technologies. Those technologies are producing higher resolution images of the subsurface, and the information that's being gathered is a direct correlation to the new discoveries that have recently been announced. The information gathered from seismic data is critical to finding new opportunities for Alaska, new reserves, and the reserves that will sustain us into the future. So when we look at a single seismic program, I thought to give you a snapshot of just what the benefits are of a single program and what it does for Alaska families. And the graph to the right is a snapshot of a single program that was acquired in the winter of 2016 called ACLAC. You can see that starting with the Kupik shareholders of 100 and moving through the prime contractor, which is SAE of 400 families, and on this particular job there were 15 subcontractors and 75 suppliers that benefited another 560 families, Alaskan families. So at the end of the day, this one job is bringing benefit to more than 1,060 Alaska families. The majority of the revenues, like I said from the previous slide, are generated and paid to Alaskan contractors and subcontractors. In this particular case, the revenue generated from the job was $57 million, $49 million of which stayed in the state of Alaska. So when we look at historical seismic investment, and I guess, again, seismic is one cog in an exploration wheel prior to development, but when we look at it, from a historical basis, and what you see across the bottom of this graph is years 2012 through 2017, you'll see the and the vertical axis is the millions of dollars of investment in seismic during that period of time. You see three horizontal, vertical red milestone dates. And what I'd like to draw your attention to is with the passage of SB 21, you see a dramatic increase in the amount of revenue, the amount of capital injection into the state of Alaska for seismic programs, the data that's required, you know, as we move into an exploration, into development, and ultimately, you know, where we're going to have to go if we're going to meet our target for 2025. The next milestone to the right is in the fall of 2015, which was the first cut in the tax appropriation, and followed by a second cut in the summer of 2016 for the tax credit appropriation. Should be said that at the same time we're seeing a dramatic drop in the commodity price. So you'll see the amount of revenue in each of 2016 and 2017 decreasing. The next slide is historical, the same data, but what I'm looking at here is the number of seismic programs, and this is not just SAE, this is all Alaska contractors and all the companies that gathered the seismic information. Again, with the passage of SB 21, you see almost a doubling effect in year one and up about another 45% in 2015. As we move to the milestones to the right, the tax appropriation cut in the fall of 2015, and again in 2016, you see those those programs or numbers of programs decreasing dramatically year over year. One thing to point out on the increase on the passage of SB 21 and the increase in the number of programs, they are also directly related to the number of companies that we're exploring. So, you know, it wasn't just the, you know, it was multiple companies exploring for data in the state. As I had mentioned before, seismic is kind of the pointy end of the spear. We're also a good indicator of where capital spending is going. Okay, so as you look at the two milestones bars to the right, you can see a dramatic decrease. In fact, they're 55% decrease year over year in 2016 and 2017. In 2017, there were only two programs being shot in the state of Alaska, only two opportunities for new data to be gathered, and only one of those is a program that's focused or will probably use tax credits as a benefit. So our perspective on Alaska's oil and gas tax policy is that SB 21 resulted in an increase of capital spending, which resulted in new opportunities and ultimately the new reserves that have been announced recently. The elimination of the tax credit budget appropriation in 2015 and again in 2016 has had several negative effects. Capital spending is down, including spending in the contractor community. There's no visibility or confidence or plan on the state's willingness or timing to settle the debts that it owes on the current and earned tax credit liabilities. And the liquidity, the money that a lot of companies, both independents and the contractor communities, need to fund projects is all but dried up because of the uncertainty. Many of the contractors in the state are still waiting to be paid for services that they've already rendered, some of them 2 years past. So the reality, what that means for a lot of companies, and I'll use those as an example, because of the delayed tax credit payout, it forced the company to a crossroads. We had a very simple decision to make. Option one was to seek protection under the Chapter 11 Bankruptcy Code and leave a lot of Alaska vendors hanging. Option two was to restructure the company and work with the Alaska subcontractors and suppliers to find a way to extend the payments until the state found a way to pay for the tax credits. We chose to restructure a company. Basically, we eliminated 90% of the equity in the company to do so. The majority of that equity was held by employees of the company. Many of them were Alaskans. You know, when I think about Alaska and the decision that we made, I came to Alaska in 1986. Right? We made investments in Alaska in the oil and gas field for three decades now. Raised a family here, have grandchildren here. We're invested in Alaska. Our intention is to stay, right? We have a great partner in the community of Nuiqsut, right? You know, they're obviously motivated. They're sitting in the center of the oil field, right? They're invested. They're willing to commit in capital dollars to continue our venture. So, you know, I think, you know, and it, just to kind of summarize where we are, I mean, we've all in the contractor community and in the oil and gas community, we're making hard choices right now. Many of us are working at cost because of the low commodity prices. Many of us are depending on you to make the right choices in terms of the tax regime that we'll see. And those aren't going to be easy choices to make. But as we look at, you know, where we go in the future, the things that we need as contractors, we need, you know, and specifically for us, you know, some of the things that HB 111 does is, you know, it's all but eliminating a secondary market in which we can sell our tax credits into. The fact that there's, in many cases, it'll cause the NOLs to be eliminated, the cash payment of the NOLs. For an explorer like us, somebody that goes out and may shoot data on a speculative basis based on, you know, what we were asked to do, you know, from the state, to find these new opportunities, to find these new reserves. That all but dries up the secondary market for us. We currently don't have any transparency. House Bill 99 does, you know, is a good job at wanting to see what that transparency is in terms of when we'll be paid, how we'll be paid, how the new tax regime will move forward. We need visibility into that to see how we're going to be able to operate as a company to make the decisions to keep investing in Alaska's future. You know, as we go forward, you know, we need a sustainable structure to go forward, one that competes on a global scale, right? When you think about the fact that the commodity price probably isn't going to rise much between above $60 or $70 a barrel in the foreseeable future, and the amount of wells in the lower 48 that can come on simply by fracking them, and the choice that is going to be made whether to invest into Alaska or invest into areas that are much easier to explore, we have to be able to compete. And whether that means, you know, increasing infrastructure and lowering our costs, or the state becoming more of a partner with us in these ventures as we go forward. The one thing that I think it's important that we don't do is create a tax environment that eliminates the ability for us to make sound decisions to invest in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hastings. Are there questions from committee members? Representative Birch and then Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hastings, for a very insightful presentation. And as a contractor, I can't imagine, you know, not being able to, you know, pay the bills when you anticipate the receipts are going to be inbound. One thing we have had, we had a presentation from the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner regarding the marketability of, I don't know if it's the very same seismic data that you're producing or not, but there is some indication that there's a large repository of seismic information on the North Slope that at some point the state of Alaska, you know, may potentially monetize. And I guess what I'm struggling with is this information money that's basically been acquired and not yet paid for. And I was curious as to, you know, do you do this work then under contract with a leaseholder, or how does this? I'm not that familiar with your business, if you will.
Representative Birch, through the chair, I think there's three different components that basically we work under. We're either contracted directly to an oil and gas producer, mm-hmm. And they apply for the credit, and once that credit is applied for, then there is a 10-year term, at which case that data then becomes public, and the state has the ability to use that, to make that data public for other potential lessees. There is the speculative data environment, which may be some of what the commissioner was talking about, in which a explorer like ourselves would go out and acquire a data in a prospective area and sell licenses for that data on an ongoing basis. Typically, on a speculative survey in the state of Alaska, you look at about 1.25 in terms of a multiple on your cost, right, for a return. Because of the fact that the data goes public in after 10 years, that period of time when you can actually capitalize on that is somewhat narrow, right? And then the other place that we acquire data in would be just strictly to another speculative company that's coming up here to acquire the data, and we're the prime contractor to that. Sorry, good.
Representative Birch?
Anything else?
No, and to follow up on what the commissioner was talking about, there is thousands of linear miles and thousands of square miles that will be coming public domain over the period of the next year to 5 years.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.
And I think just as a comment, the number one is the one that the department is working through right now, because we've just hit the 10-year threshold from the first batch of that, I think, is the one that they're working through.
That's correct.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Birch, for raising that subject. It's been a little bit of a pet issue for me as well. I'm sorry to say that things don't happen very fast in government.
No.
Who would have thought? But I'd be interested in knowing, with the indulgence of the chair, if I may ask a little bit about on the subject.
Certainly. Let's pose your questions and we'll work them through.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I gather from what you've said that the state interposing itself as a basically a free purveyor of this information has a negative impact on your company's bottom line. Is that correct?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, question, are you saying the fact that it is going public in a certain period of time?
Yeah, and we're providing it for, sorry, through the chair, we're providing it for next to no cost to the general public. We're putting ourselves in basically as a competitor. You mentioned in item two that you can anticipate a 1.25 return on your cost, return on your investment.
Representative Parrish, through the chair, just as a point of clarity, if that data were to stay proprietary to the owner of the data and not go public after the 10-year, a typical seismic speculative program would yield about 1.5 multiple. With that being said, the way we model our business in Alaska is to expect only a 1.25 multiple, and therefore have already taken into account that data is going to be public domain.
Follow up. Well, I meant to say right at the beginning, I don't think I got around to it, but I really do appreciate your company's commitment to local and Alaska Native hire, and I want us to help your company thrive within the constraints of our fiscal situation. You mentioned the importance of a secondary market for tax credits. If we were to, right now it seems like the markets are a little muddled about who gets to grab the statutorily recommended payment. I've been mulling over the possibility of allocating perhaps slightly more for the tax credits payments and sending them out the door on a competitive basis. If, for instance, everyone wants a dollar for a tax credit and you offer 99 cents, we fill all of your tax credits first. Would that be something that would be of use to your company?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, I think that in terms of the secondary market, everybody has their own threshold in terms of their need for cash to operate their business. And so in providing an answer to you, I think that some people would have a different opinion of maybe what we would have in terms of what we would take for a tax credit. We're of the opinion that we have already, by means of our restructuring, felt the pain, restructured our company in such a way that we can hopefully sustain ourselves into the future and through this dip in the commodity price. And so we would be reluctant and maybe, to take a steeply discounted offer for our current credits.
Thank you, and thank you, co-chairs, for your indulgence.
Do we have any other questions for Mr. Hastings?
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm glad you could join us this evening and appreciate your patience with getting worked into the schedule. Before we close out today, just a few housekeeping items. Wanted to recognize that Representative Guerra joined us a few moments ago. Thank you for joining us. We did invite, as far as companies for invited testimony, a couple of companies that weren't available to present to us in person. So Hillcorp has submitted a letter. All members should have that letter, and it should be available on BASIS. But let us know if you haven't seen it yet, and we'll get it to you. We invited Armstrong, but they were not available to testify. And then remaining individuals are testifying on Friday. So the groups we haven't heard from yet, I know Exxon's on Friday, Conoco's on Friday, and Great Bear, I think, is that that's everybody, for Friday's meeting. So, again, we did invite others, and some were able and some were not, and Hillcorp submitted the letter. So that's one housekeeping item. A second is that we did submit the questions to Mr. Ruggiero, including the question about the slide that Ms. Moriarty presented at the beginning. So I will make sure that he has seen the slide that she used, and he will be prepared to respond to that question or have it come back up when he's in person on Monday. So we'll make sure he's ready to answer those questions and give some of his thoughts on the more recent data. There was a letter from Department of Revenue in response to some questions that had come up in two different committee meetings. It's about a 15-page document, I want to say, with several tables addressing questions. That has been distributed to committee members as well as available online for anyone that's interested in that. And then there was a question by Representative Birch about the multiplier in ACEs, so we went back and found where that took place in the House Finance Committee, November 10, 2007. It was Representative Mike Kelly from Fairbanks who offered the amendment, which would increase progressivity to 0.4%. Representative Kelly, in his comments, he said the amendment is about getting the state's value for the product and resource. He emphasized that the work of the legislature is to establish a solid future tax policy to send a message of stability to the oil companies. In order to rebuild the trust of the people of Alaska, progressivity should be at the rate that the governor's recommended. He urged support, and then a roll call vote was taken, and the motion passed 6-5. So we will present those committee minutes to the extent they're of interest for members, because that was also a question that had come up. And with that, I think those are all of our housekeeping items. So thank you for everybody being here this evening. We'll look forward to continued testimony on Friday. And with that, we will adjourn at 8:02 p.m.